Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. The world is on the cusp of a global opioid crisis. It's driven by the overuse of legal painkillers and the rise of fentanyl, a synthetic opioid which is easy to produce and to transport. What do governments need to do to curb the opioid supply and to treat those who are addicted? How can countries work together to prevent a global crisis from occurring? Joining us to discuss these questions is Keith Humphreys. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Stanford University. And Herman Lopez, senior correspondent at the online media source Vox. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Keith Humphreys, the latest projections predict that more than a half a million people, roughly the number of people who died in the entire Vietnam War on the U.S. side, are going to die in the United States due to opioid use over the next decade, year after year after year. If not uniquely, then at least specifically American contexts that accompany the rapid rise in the number of annual deaths and the continuous rise in the number of addicted people in the U.S.
Yes, it's definitely the case that we have this epidemic because of our poor regulation of the pharmaceutical industry, which makes us different from Europe, for example, or other developed nations like Australia and New Zealand. We took the constraints off in the 1990s, and that was done in part through humanitarian reasons. I mean, people were concerned about untreated pain, which is a very serious problem, but that got translated into the idea that more and more people should be on opioids for chronic pain conditions, you know, bad backs and wobbly knees and fibromyalgia and headaches and things like that. And we've almost quadrupled our level of prescribing to a level no other country on earth has ever experienced. And that's what got millions of people addicted. And that was a almost uniquely American problem. Canada has a bit of this, but we really stand out in the world for the prevalence of our prescription opioid use.
Herman Lopez, a lot of the United States' peer countries in terms of standard of living, GDP, comprehensive health system that's available to the average citizen, they don't have this problem. Why is that? What's not happening in a place like Germany or France that is happening in the United States?
Well, as Keith alluded to, the big thing that started this opioid epidemic was the fact that the U.S. opened the faucet on opioid painkillers. And in other countries, they have better regulatory systems in place to handle like pharmaceutical marketing. And that might have played a big role in stopping these other nations from letting their doctors essentially prescribe opioids willy-nilly. And that's a big problem. But I think and then on the other side, once the epidemic has gotten rolling, the fact of the matter is like the U.S. is alone in that it does not have a universal healthcare system among developed nations. So once the epidemic did start, the people who needed addiction treatment needed to access a healthcare system to get treated and avoid overdose and that kind of thing. They didn't have as easy access to addiction treatment as they would in other places. So it's kind of those two things. It's one end, the opioid painkillers, the proliferation of them really got a lot of people addicted to these drugs. And then once people were addicted, they didn't have nearly as many options as they might in, say, France or Germany or Denmark or Canada even to get their addiction treated.
So, Professor Humphreys, where are the places in the world that may be looking at an American-style opioid crisis? If other wealthy industrialized countries have a different profile when it comes to these highly addictive substances, are there places in the world that are looking at the possibility of an American problem?
There are, and whether they get it is going to depend how wary they are, frankly, of American companies. So what happened in the United States about 10 years ago is the biggest producer of the opioids that were killing people, it was called OxyContin. It was produced by a company named Purdue Pharma, pled guilty in federal court to mismarketing those products. They paid a $600 million fine and agreed to accept some constraints on how they marketed the drug. But the family that owns that company, the Sackler family, owns another company called Mundipharma that is operating in many different countries around the world using the same tactics that Purdue Pharma used here. High-pressure sales tactics, over-promoting the product, hiring influential doctors to give speeches about how great the products are. So, you know, there have been efforts to alert the rest of the world that this is coming, just as it came with tobacco. When we started to regulate tobacco more tightly in this country, the tobacco industry went overseas where people didn't know as much about them and didn't regulate them as tightly. So my hope is that other countries will learn from our very tragic experience and not fall for the same tricks. Some of those countries, by the way, some European countries, Spain has had a big push by Mundi Pharma, Australia, developed countries, but also a lot of developing countries like the Philippines or Egypt are examples where Mundi Pharma is active pushing their products.
Are they, let's say, particularly vulnerable? Because in places where there aren't built out, highly financed, highly capitalized health systems yet, in a lot of places in the developing world, there aren't enough doctors, there aren't enough hospitals, there aren't enough pharmacies. Your per-patient cost would go down if you just write somebody a prescription and send them home with a bottle of pills. The follow-up, the observation, the checking back that therapy is working or effective, that drives up patient cost in countries where they're trying desperately to keep costs down.
It's very much a challenge. I mean, first you have the political challenge. The truth is a lot of the multinational corporations can bring more money to bear on marketing than any poorer country can bring to bear on regulating. So they have a huge structural advantage to begin with. And then there are the factors you just elucidated, that the cheapest thing oftentimes is to write a prescription. And in fairness to low and middle income countries, they have the opposite problem as us generally. We have way too many opioids. But they often don't have enough. So they have people, you know, dying of bone cancer without any adequate pain relief, which is horrible. And, you know, that may lead them to say, well, you know, we don't want to have the same thing go on in the U.S., but we also don't want people in agony. And these people seem like they're giving us an option, so we'll take it. So one, I think, response we need to have in a humanitarian way would be to engage those countries to get them, you know, generic morphine for adequate pain relief for people who have cancer, people who are terminally ill, so that they're not faced with this terrible decision of either going without pain relief or signing on to a potential opioid epidemic pushed by a multinational corporation.
You know, Germán, when you travel in other parts of the world, people are still working with their backs. They're still working with their arms and shoulders. Repetitive motion injuries. There are factories that use practices that have long been absent from Western European and North American production. Where basically the jobs that hurt people, we've basically sourced them out. It's horrifying to think of a lifetime of untreated or undertreated pain. Yet at the same time, there are still these places are the likely places in the world where you're going to have lost limbs, crush injuries, repetitive motion injuries, where you're going to have the very problems that lead to chronic pain. And here we are trying to figure out how to just lift the lid on the painkiller industry very slowly and carefully.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even just that those countries, that a lot of this labor has been outsourced to them. It's that they have poor regulations, right? So, like, on top of that, they are more likely to have these injuries because their labor regulations are just awful. But, I mean, on that point, I think that's really what a lot of these pharmaceutical companies have taken advantage of, is that they can point to these cases and say, like, look, there are these people suffering from pain. There are these people who probably could have benefited from opioids. So why don't we try to do more to treat pain? Why don't we try to do more to improve access to opioids? And the thing is that it's just you have to strike a balance with this. You do have to find a place where you can offer people opioids when they need them. But at the same time, you also have to keep in mind that these are highly addictive, dangerous drugs, and that they can result in a lot of people dying, as we've seen in the U.S. So that's where pharmaceutical companies have been. I mean, they have an incentive to push as much prescribing as possible. They just make the most profits from this. And that's really the issue here, is how do you strike that balance if government regulations aren't properly set in place to resist when pharmaceutical companies come in and tell doctors, hey, you can prescribe as many of these as possible, it will be safe and effective. Contrary to all the evidence, that's where government regulators should be stepping in, but very often in the U.S. that hasn't happened. Hopefully it will happen in other countries after they've seen our experience.
When you are in an American pharmacy, just walk up and down the aisles and pick bottles off the shelf. This is a global industry, and whether you're talking prescription or over-the-counter, you might be surprised to find out that the pill you're about to take for the sniffles or body aches was made in Israel, was made in Brazil, was made in India, was made in China. Have illicit drugs, Herman, in the same way as legit drugs, gone global in their supply chains?
Well, illicit drugs are definitely an international market. I mean, the U.S. does use, if you go from country to country, you're going to see different preferences for different drugs. So, for example, in the U.S., like fentanyl has really taken off in certain parts of the U.S., I should say. There's even variation within states. So the fentanyl has really taken off, which is a synthetic opioid, and heroin has obviously taken off as well, along with opioid painkillers. Where in European countries, you might see more prevalence of cocaine still. Like opioids might not be the biggest drug problem there, perhaps yet. So it totally varies. It depends on different supply chains. Like a lot of the drug trafficking in Europe comes through West Africa, for example, and they might be producing or trafficking different substances that might be coming through Central America and Canada and China. So that's where you'll see variation. But in the end, these are international drug trafficking routes, right? Like a lot of the heroin, the fentanyl coming into the U.S. is coming from China. It's coming from Canada. It's coming from South and Central America. So that's clearly a sign that it's international.
Keith Humphreys, have the international cartels that were already supplying America's seemingly insatiable appetite for illicit drugs been put under pressure by these new entrants into the marketplace? Is a Sinaloa cartel feeling the heat from Chinese fentanyl? Or are they broadening their offerings and jumping into new product lines in order to meet new market realities?
This is one of the most interesting things happening in illegal drug trades, and also, I'd say, in foreign policy around drugs. If you are an Afghan warlord who's been growing opium poppies and is able to employ a large number of people and become a local person of significance, fentanyl is terrifying to you because some kid in a lab can make more in a day than you can harvest in a year and put you out of business. Some drug trafficking organizations have adapted to that by going into fentanyl. In Mexico, JNG is an example of that. Sinaloa a little bit also. Others have not, whether it's because they can't get the chemicals and the facilities to make it. It's not exactly clear. But as in any other business, innovations make some people huge profits and put some other people out of business. And what I find most interesting as a drug policy analyst is, will we get to a point where anybody who's producing their drugs fundamentally from plants, from agriculture, is the equivalent of the horse and buggy of the automotive industry?
Well, what happens down at ground level if you're a coca farmer in South America, if you've been growing poppy in Afghanistan? Does it mean that the price you get for selling to middlemen who do most of the value-added processing goes down and you're put under pressure? Are you sort of whipped by your middlemen into making more in order to make those numbers match a little better? Or does it mean cheaper drugs pouring into more vulnerable places in the world?
It's a time of extreme uncertainty around all of those questions, as usually the case when a market is disrupted by a new innovation. So if you are a coca farmer, on the one hand, you could lose your livelihood because you can no longer get the kind of payments you used to be able to get from coca, let's say if it's driven out by synthetic methamphetamine, as an example. On the other hand, the U.S. may no longer be interested in spraying your farm or your neighbor's farm, because that's not going to be the place that they're worried about getting stopping drug production. So that's advantageous to drug-producing countries if they can get out of this, you know, constant fight with richer nations who are always telling them, please stop producing all these drugs. And the people in those countries think, well, look, I got to feed my family, and you know, it's not my fault that you guys use drugs. If that went away, it could open up new possibilities for, you know, different kinds of agriculture, different kinds of development, and a better legitimate global trading relationship, which could bring some wealth and benefit to that very same, you know, cocoa farming family in Colombia or Peru or Bolivia.
Well, Herman, what does that mean down the road? I mean, are we talking about a United States that isn't sending patrol boats to the Colombian and Peruvian coasts, that isn't sending crop dusters and planes that spread defoliants and so on into South American jungles? Does it mean that there aren't American-financed strike teams in the highlands of Central America looking for vast marijuana farms? I mean, there's been a big part of our bilateral relations with a lot of the countries in Latin America that has strictly to do with drug interdiction and drug interdictions spread into political problems, as with the FARC in Colombia.
Right. I mean, this, like, I think it's still an open question just exactly how this will look. But personally, from like somebody observing this, I think there are a few possibilities. One is that we still end up having a lot of operations in these countries as part of the broader like anti-drug efforts, just because they might start opening up a bunch of labs for fentanyl, right? So and the labs for other synthetic drugs for that matter. And so it would still be advantageous, in according to this framework, to go after those labs and try to shut them down. It would look different than what we've done in recent decades, trying to essentially shut down farms. Like shutting down a farm is obviously different than shutting down a lab. So that's one way it could play out. Another thing that I've heard as a concern from both federal officials and experts who are looking at this is that there are now a bunch of efforts to stop fentanyl, for example, from coming into the country by stopping that in international mail, by doing things at the border, like doing more things to just keep fentanyl out. But one possibility is that because fentanyl is relatively easy to produce, is we might see a more domestic labs. So the U.S. might start having to look more inward to see what happens with these domestic labs, not just producing fentanyl, by the way, but again, other synthetic drugs. It is amazing how many like synthetic drugs are being produced year over year. So, and that's a big question, is just where the U.S. will have to balance out its anti-drug efforts if it's going to focus on these supply efforts, if it's going to have to look domestically at a whole bunch of new domestic labs, or if it's going to have to look internationally at these labs in other countries. We don't know how it will shake out. But at the end of the day, these drugs are going to come from somewhere. So my guess is that, like, as long as we take this supply-focused anti-drug framework, there's going to be somewhere where these like drug officials are gonna, the anti-drug officials are gonna be working.
Well, Professor, both you and Herman have talked about the conflict between the farm and the lab, the rise of China as a source of American illicit product. I guess we don't have to look much further than Mexico to see this recently played out in real time. Meth labs used to be scattered across the great agricultural Midwest, often their presence covered up by pig farms, which have a pretty noxious smell and would cover up some of the odor from a meth lab. But those places got rolled up and swamped by product from Mexico. Mexico became the meth supplier, and that was the case of a lab-based product being swept right out from under domestic producers' feet. How does fentanyl compare when we look at those models, or is a similar thing rolling out?
Actually, fentanyl is very similar to meth. We actually had a fentanyl market that emerged briefly about 15 years ago, and it was shut down by law enforcement, by DEA, and seemed to kill it off. But that organization was based here in the United States. Now the producers are based, you know, far away in China, and there's much less we can do about it, and they can produce these very cheaply, in part because a lot of the production is completely legal and can be out in the open in China. The second thing is, you know, it's really different in a foreign policy sense or a law enforcement sense to, say, try to push around a Peru or a Guatemala versus pushing around China. You can't push around China. They are going to be one of the dominant powers of this century. So if they don't want to help or they're irritated at us, for example, if we're in the midst of a trade war with them, they can thwart almost any type of law enforcement effort if they want to. And that gives the traffickers a huge advantage. You know, you're better off being based in a powerful country that doesn't enforce than in a weak country that doesn't enforce.
Germán, earlier we talked about the behavior of American-based multinational drug companies. How come the heat on them that's been rising in the United States is not simply mirrored elsewhere? It's been mentioned that they go to greener pastures. They look for places with less enforcement. They look for places with less restrictive legal regimes. Well, don't countries go to school on each other? I mean, people must know that we've got tens of thousands of people in America dying every year from using these drugs.
In general, I think you haven't seen that much of a push yet in other countries just because they haven't experienced this problem. I mean, if you look at the U.S. example, it took a while into the opioid epidemic, like a decade or so in, for the U.S. itself to really react to the overdose deaths happening. It wasn't the opioid epidemic, by most accounts, started in the mid to late 90s, and the CDC didn't declare it an epidemic until, I think, 2011. So you see that gap. Even the U.S. facing its own problem was slow to react. I think a lot of countries feel that this is a uniquely American problem, and for that reason, they probably won't do much, if anything, until it becomes a problem for them. And that's obviously a vulnerability here because these big companies are looking at other places as their U.S. market shrinks to grow and expand. So that's something that we'll just have to keep an eye on. If like opioid companies start advertising a lot in some of these other countries, how quick are they to react? Because there's a lot of belief and evidence that if the U.S. had caught this earlier, then perhaps it wouldn't have gotten so bad, right? If it stopped the opioid painkiller problem before we were talking about tens of thousands of overdose deaths, then maybe there would have been way fewer people who started getting into heroin. Maybe the fentanyl epidemic wouldn't have had a chance to take off simply because it just wouldn't have been in the black market yet. But as we've seen, that didn't happen, and the U.S. now dealing with, well, the worst drug crisis it's ever dealt with.
One of the biggest aspects of pharma's worldwide business, Professor, is protecting its compounds, protecting its formulas. Does that apply? Is that part of the story, even when we're dealing with drugs that are leaching from legitimate into illicit markets?
It absolutely does. You know, and it's an interesting phenomenon that has happened with some of these drugs like OxyContin when its patent was up. And it was able to be made as a generic. The manufacturer filed a request with the FDA to say that a generic OxyContin would be too dangerous and that they had developed a new, they said, more resistant OxyContin, strangely enough. And you have to wonder, like, how can you make that petition if you've been selling this product for that long? But what they're doing is trying to keep other people out of this market, which lets them keep their prices high and have a unified branding strategy and that sort of thing. How that plays out in other countries, I'd be honest, I don't really know the extent to which, you know, you can control a patent in a place like, you know, Egypt or Algeria or the Philippines. But I'm quite sure they know and have worked out ways to, you know, sell their product while at the same time keeping control of it and protecting their brand and their profit stream.
Well, does the risk of leakage of that branding power, of that protection power, rise when you widen your global supply chain, when product starts to be made by subsidiaries in other places in the world?
Definitely, and including counterfeits, which are very common now, working in the shadows of the legitimate industry, for example, in places like India and China, who may put out products with the same name and they look exactly like your product, but they aren't your product. And they can contain all kinds of things that are dangerous. And that could then further stigmatize the, you know, your brand and your company. That's a risk they take as they move out of a more, you know, the more regulated structured markets that they've had in the U.S. and Canada.
Germán, one interesting aspect of this problem as it goes global, as it emigrates from the United States, is that different countries end up having problems with different drugs. And it's fascinating how that happens. But for instance, in Southern Africa, there's said to be a wide and spreading and growing tramadol problem. It's a very specific drug. It's a very specific problem in a geographical area. And I'm wondering if you can sort of explain how that happens, how one country gets a problem with one drug and another country gets a problem with a different one.
It comes down to like all sorts of factors, but a big one is definitely just economics. Like, is this drug affordable? Do you have a healthcare system in place, if it's coming through the healthcare system, that can actually distribute these drugs, right? So with the U.S., like, there was a lot of structure in place, like a lot of doctors ready to prescribe opioids and a lot of pharmacies to fill those prescriptions. And in places like Southern Africa, their healthcare systems aren't as big, but still, like you mentioned, we've seen that tramadol expansion there. And that seems to be because it's a relatively cheap drug, and it's for whatever reason, it has been marketed as not prone to misuse. And for like geographic variation and all that comes into play as well. But what it comes down to is just different socioeconomic factors.
But once it gets established, and, you know, we're talking about middle-class countries around the world now. I mean, South Africa is sort of sub-Saharan Africa's economic engine, and you've got Turkey is an Eastern Mediterranean regional champion in a growing economy, a Brazil, a Mexico. Are these countries vulnerable? Are these countries exploitable? Are these countries prone to having a problem like this just because of these forces? Or are they able to do something to defend against it? Is there a model of success anywhere in the world where you can point to a country, a specific drug problem, and say, aha, they figured it out. They didn't let it happen in their own backyard.
It's really difficult to point to a specific country and try to apply their model to others. But generally what we know is that there's like a threat in these other countries where it's sort of like once you hit a sweet spot of like socioeconomic success, once you have a healthcare system in place that can distribute drugs, where drugs can be heavily marketed and there's like a large consumer base for them, that's when you begin running into these dangers. And not just opioids, by the way, but also other things like alcohol and tobacco. Like, those can become bigger problems in wealthier nations just because there will be more customers for those products. So what you have to do essentially is prepare for that. Like, look at what the problem in the U.S. is, that regulations for doctors, the healthcare system, pharmaceuticals just were not good enough. They were not strong enough. The FDA wasn't keeping a close enough eye on this issue. The DEA wasn't keeping a close enough eye on this issue. And that made it possible for pharmaceutical companies to get away with marketing these drugs irresponsibly for years and years and years. Whereas in places like, say, Europe and Japan, they have many more regulations over the healthcare system, and particularly on marketing. So that's kind of the things that other newer countries coming up might want to look at. Is just how do these other European countries, how did Japan shape its regulatory system in place? And another thing is just culture. For whatever reason, if you go to a place like Japan and ask a doctor, would you prescribe opioids for this kind of pain? They're going to be much more resistant than a doctor in the U.S. And I think a lot of that may come down to that they're just more willing to accept lower levels of pain in their day-to-day life than perhaps Americans are. They may be more realistic about the restraints of age and how you get older, you're just going to be able to do less in your life. And in America, that just doesn't seem to have taken off. So I think it's not even just these regulatory systems, but also these cultural forces as well that other places will have to keep in mind.
Rapidly developing countries, you mentioned, Brazil, India, China, South Africa, they can start consuming many more drugs of all sorts, alcohol, tobacco, pharmaceuticals, and so on. And at that moment, if you try to say, all right, let's start taxing these things heavily, let's start regulating them tightly, let's really control our imports and exports, you will get a visit from the commerce minister or the economics minister or the head of state saying, hey, wait a minute, we're trying to make it into the first world. And the way we're doing that is by, letting the good times roll for industry. We want to be attractive for investment. We don't want to impose a lot of burdens on these companies. And that tends to rule the day, just as it does sometimes in the United States when, you think, like, why would a town consent to have a dirty chemical factory nearby that they know is bad for their health and destroys the environment? And they'll say, look, we need the jobs, and these people provide jobs. That's the situation a lot of those middle-income countries are in. And certainly China, they've got hundreds of pharmaceutical countries and thousands of chemical manufacturers and an export-led economy. It's hard to persuade them when they feel they're finally making it to say, all right, why don't you tighten up on that industry? Why don't you tax it? Why don't you regulate it? Why don't you control exports more? And they'd say, hey, we don't have that luxury. We're trying to get into the first world, and this is how we're going to do it.
You teach behavioral sciences. What do you make of Herman's other point about there just being different national profiles in various places around the world in the cultural response to pain and what it means to be in pain?
It's absolutely the case. I mean, American healthcare has a very strong consumer mentality. We rate our doctors on Yelp and you're actually badgered practically anytime you go to the hospital to fill out 1,000 satisfaction forms and is the customer right and so on. And that's partly a consequence of the for-profit healthcare system where everybody's competing for business. And it would be different in a country where, you had universal healthcare, so that wasn't really an issue. I did some research on this, trying to look at pain, and finding countries that are very similar to the U.S. in their pain profile. And one of them is France. The amount of people say they're in pain is very similar. The age structure is roughly similar. But we consume about 5 times as many opioids per capita. And I think that has something to do with culture. I mean, if I go to I'm 52. If I go to my American doctor and say, I just ran a marathon, the same marathon I ran when I was 20, and I hurt. Fix me, doc. My doctor will probably scramble around and try to fix me. You say that to a French doctor, and they'll say, c'est la vie, mon ami. You're getting older. Have a glass of wine. What do you want from me? I can't fix life for you. There's a certain amount of pain, and just accept it. And that leads them to have a different sense of, like, what can a doctor do? What is tolerable and what is intolerable? And I say that not to minimize. There are people in excruciating pain. That's absolutely true in all countries. But that can't explain why 100 million Americans a year get an opioid. There's not that many people in excruciating pain in the U.S.
Well, how do you hit the sweet spot then? How does a national medical service, and in many places in the world, and certainly in the developing country, there are national systems, unlike what we have in the United States. How does it respond to a population's need for pain management without letting the addiction genie out of the bottle, without abusively or haphazardly prescribing pain medication, when follow-up is difficult, when directly observed therapy, where the doctor watches you take the pills and keeps them, so you have to come to him to get them. How do you keep this from happening in other places?
My bias is, the scientific one, which is you look at what the evidence says about what opioids are good for and what they're not good for. And they're terrifically helpful in cancer. They're terrifically helpful in palliative care. I worked in hospice for almost a decade. Hospice would be horrifying without opioids. It's incredible the great relief those drugs can give. They're excellent for acute pain, too. But the evidence we have for chronic pain, in other words, pain that goes on for more than 3 months or so, is that opioids aren't that good because you start to become tolerant to them and they don't have the same benefit for pain relief as they used to, and they start to have a lot of nasty side effects. And it'd be far better to rely on other types of medications, non-opioid medications, or sometimes it's other types of interventions that are not pharmaceutical at all, like, you know, physical therapy, you know, helps many, many people. So if you stick to that, stick to what the evidence says, that gives you the, you know, the guiding star that you should pursue, and then you want to set up your policy to support that. If you're, like, when I talk to insurers, I often, you know, who are worried about, well, they're going to pay for a lot of people opioid addiction treatment. I say, you know, if you don't want to do that, how about reimbursing physical therapy adequately, so that people don't get to the point that they have to have opioids for everything, but there are other options for them.
We've been hearing from Keith Humphreys and Herman Lopez on the global reach of the opioid epidemic. After the break, Ray Suarez will speak to our guests about what needs to be done from a policy perspective to stop the crisis from spreading. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Keith Humphreys. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Stanford University. And Herman Lopez. He's a senior correspondent at the online media source Vox. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
The story in the early days of the epidemic here in the United States involved people who started out on legitimate, monitored pain management, and then at some point, when their insurance ran out, when the costs got prohibitive, they crossed over into an illicit market. Herman, is the profile going to be the same in other places in the world as opioids go global?
I mean, that remains to be seen. Here in the U.S., it's like one thing that's been interesting in recent years is that as the illicit market for heroin and fentanyl has grown, more people have actually started along those lines when they start on the path to opioid addiction. And that suggests that, like, it's a lot of it is supply. So in the mid-90s to late 90s, a lot of people tapped into opioid painkillers, but there was perhaps not as much heroin and definitely not fentanyl in the market. But as heroin and fentanyl have become bigger parts of the black market and how those markets have grown, they've just become more accessible, right? It's way easier to now go to a drug dealer and say, I want some heroin or fentanyl and get it than it was a few decades ago. So just because there's far more of it, and it's also probably cheaper because there's far more of it. So I think it'll come down to, in other countries, where you start seeing the supply explode first. Like, is it going to be on the painkiller side? Like, is the healthcare system going to start offering a bunch of these opioids? Or is fentanyl going to start popping up in your illicit markets? And that's where it'll really take off. I think that's ultimately what it'll come down to.
If you headed out onto the streets of New York or Washington, D.C. or Boston or Chicago, Herman, would it take you a long time to get hooked up? Would it be a fairly easy thing to buy some fentanyl?
I'm not totally sure about every one of those cities, and it probably depends on neighborhoods. But I know in, like, some places, like in Philadelphia, there are huge entire neighborhoods where it would not be remotely difficult for anyone to get drugs. And not only that, but, like, everyone in the city knows where those places are I know, and when I used to live in Cincinnati, and it was a similar story there, it was not hard to figure out where you get illicit drugs there. And it's just that's one of the big problems is like when you have these giant drug markets already existing there, if suddenly you hear that they're getting a bunch of highly potent opioid and you are addicted to opioids, then like that makes it a more attractive option, right? Like if you're hearing that this fentanyl is so strong that it might be causing like your friends to overdose because it's so strong, if you want the strongest high, you might think, as weird as it might seem to like us to think about, you might think, oh, well, maybe this is the good stuff and I should go get that good stuff. And yeah, so going back to your question, I think it'll depend on the city and on the neighborhood, but there are places in cities where everyone knows you can buy drugs and it's not exactly difficult to do so.
Well, I'm recording this program in downtown Philadelphia, and we're probably, I would say a 12-minute subway ride away from the neighborhood the New York Times dubbed the Walmart of opioids, a neighborhood just on the north side. And it is not only surprising how open the illicit trade is, but how cheap it all is. And Professor, I'm guessing the way markets work, that makes all of this only that much harder.
Yeah, that is correct. The street price for black tar heroin, which is what we have here in California where I'm sitting, is about a third of diverted OxyContin. So you can easily imagine someone who is, maybe they need 20 OxyContin pills a day, their money is out, and it's extraordinarily attractive to switch and be able to take three times as much for the same price or do a little dealing yourself on the side on top and keep your own habit going. I mean, drugs are like any other commodity, even for addicted people. You know, the price really matters, and the price right now is extremely cheap all over the country, which is the other important change is, you know, we've had heroin in East Coast cities, you mentioned, for a very long time. But one of the changes that happened is it's far more developed now in smaller cities, you know, the Youngstown, Ohio's, the Huntington, West Virginia's, places like that where heroin was a very minor presence, have now robust heroin markets that were started up by organizations realizing correctly that where you have lots and lots of people addicted to prescription pills, you have potential customers for heroin.
Well, for listeners who have gotten this far into the program and are utterly and totally bummed out, and many are going to know someone who's been touched by this, it sounds like the world, it's going to be very difficult for the rest of the world to avoid this. And it sounds like we in the United States have gone so far down this road, it almost seems hard to undo. So I'd like to spend this last third of the program talking about walking this back. These substances are tremendously powerful, incredibly addictive, and very good at what they do. And along with a pain relief, many of them are accompanied by a kind of euphoria, a kind of feeling that leaves people open to addiction, saying, I want to feel that way again. And unlike people who needed $100 bills to do a line of cocaine 35 years ago, these drugs are cheap, cheap, cheap. It just seems like the world has a bullseye on its back as you start to think about how this could all go. So, Herman, give me something to hold on to here.
Well, I think one source of good news is opioids are unique in the sense that we actually have a very, very good treatment for them. And that is buprenorphine, methadone, naltrexone. These medications, you usually hear this referred to as medication-assisted treatment or MAT. And these medications are really good. Studies show that if people get on them and stay on them, their risk of death is reduced by half or more. People who are on who are addicted to opioids, their death rate dramatically plummets. So that's one good source of news here, right? That we do have ways to treat this. I guess the bad news to that though is that in a lot of the U.S., these medications just are not available. Addiction treatment just is not adequate. So there's a way out here in that we know that these treatments can work much better than like if we were in a middle of a cocaine or meth epidemic, it would be much more difficult to figure out how do we treat ourselves out of this, because there just aren't equivalent medications. But with opioids, we do have these medications, and that gives us an exit here. The thing is that it's going to take a lot of investment to scale up addiction treatment. Some states like Vermont, Rhode Island, Massachusetts are doing that, and they are seeing positive results. They've seen overdose deaths actually drop in recent years. But in a lot of other parts of the country, including West Virginia, which has by far the worst overdose death rate in the U.S., you have not seen such a dramatic investment. And as long as they don't treat the people who are addicted, you're going to keep seeing death.
Is it expensive?
I mean, if you look at studies, it's cost effective, because treating people, making sure they no longer have to, that they're no longer using the healthcare system when they overdose, when they have infections, when they have all sorts of other problems that come out of their opioid addiction, that's going to be cheaper. And I mean, some of these drugs, particularly like there's methadone, which is incredibly cheap. There's generic forms of buprenorphine. That Suboxone, which is a brand name that most people might be familiar with, is more expensive. And naltrexone is probably the most expensive out of the three. But in general, these medications are cost effective. They will save you money for treating people is just better than letting them like suffer and linger in the healthcare system and suffer from all sorts of other conditions that will ultimately cost a lot of money.
Professor Humphreys?
It's important to think about prescription opioids in the context of the other, you know, two drugs that kill the most people in the United States, which are alcohol and tobacco. And those are all corporate produced by legal corporations that are lightly regulated. But countries that regulate them more tightly, or even within the United States, states that regulate them more tightly, have far fewer cases of addiction and death from those legally produced drugs. So I think the lesson there is we should dramatically increase the amount of regulation, whether it's in form of taxation, limits on advertising. I mean, one of the things I always find extraordinary is the advertising of alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceuticals is all tax deductible. It's a business expense. It doesn't have to be that way. The taxpayer doesn't need to subsidize that. There are other countries that control these legal industries much more tightly. So that's an optimistic, conclusion. If we were willing to do that, we would benefit enormously with public health on the prevention side. And then I agree absolutely with what Herman is saying. If we more generously covered addiction treatment and built it into the core of American healthcare, not made it a sideline or something, there's a 2-year grant to do addiction treatment, which is often what comes out of Congress, but actually an enduring commitment to take care of addiction and pain, like we expect to take care of cancer and heart disease and diabetes. If we did that, I think we'd save a large number of lives, and not just from addiction, from lots of other health conditions as well.
If we cast our eyes out to the rest of the world and look at some of these countries where multinational pharmaceutical companies are saying, I want in. What can those countries do on the front end, perhaps even making entry to the marketplace a conditional upon also helping with some of the unintentional or downstream costs of having those drugs available in a population, almost a cigarette model?
The smartest thing they could do is adapt the tightest first world levels of regulation of these products. And that's hard for them because they're, in the midst of transition and they have, no tradition of regulation and are fearful of sometimes offending corporations where they went to business and all that. But in the long term, they will be much, much better off to adopt a really strict regime from the first. Because if you don't do that, by the time you get around to it, usually those industries are much, much more powerful than they were to begin with, and it's harder to tighten up regulation later. So you want to start tight and stringent and go slow on any changes that you make.
I'm sure these companies spread a lot of money around in national legislatures and that kind of thing. It's not like it's a symmetrical battle, is it?
No. In fact, the Associated Press and the Center for Public Integrity did a study in the U.S. of donations to state legislator candidates. And they showed for people trying to tighten control on opioids over a decade, $4 million was given. For the pharmaceutical companies, $880 million was given. So it's a million miles from a fair fight. And it does. It's going to take, you know, some leadership, also some other political reforms. At the moment in the U.S., we have a system where companies can give as much as they want to the political candidates they want. It wasn't always that way. It doesn't have to be that way. That's a change we could make that would, I think, benefit us not just on this issue, but actually on a number of issues where there's a conflict between corporate profit and public health and well-being.
Germán, even with the image you gave us of a model that might work, treatment-based, taking a look at addicted people in a different way, this is asymmetric warfare. I mean, people with an interest in selling product, regardless of their downstream social costs, have a lot of the money in this fight, even compared to whole nations.
Right. And I mean, there are also lots of cultural problems here, and that there is still a lot of stigma around addiction. So when talking about that treatment side of things, there are still a lot of people who are like, why should we put any money towards that? Like, these people brought that on themselves. I mean, I get a lot of nasty emails when I write about this of people just saying, like, survival of the fittest, those kinds of things in reaction to people who are suffering from opioid addiction. So that to me speaks to, like, there's still a large cultural barrier there where you have to actually convince people that this is a medical condition, it is treatable, and the healthcare system can be built up, as Keith has said, so the insurance companies pay for it, so there are actually clinics in your area, just like we would expect for any other medical condition. So people who are struggling with this can get treatment, but in that there will be a large cultural force to overcome there as long as people have this stigmatized view towards addiction. And that will help these companies who, at the end of the day, they can come in, they have hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, to pour into advertising campaigns where they can say, hey, my drugs are good and effective. And it's an asymmetrical battle in a lot of ways. And that's just another dimension of it.
You know, in rural America now, in many places that all three of us could name, there are funeral directors who are saying that all their body storage places are full and they have to send people 25 miles down the road to the next funeral home. The obituary columns in local weekly newspapers are filled with people dying in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. This is hitting with hurricane force, and it's just sort of jaw-dropping that we're looking at standing at the edge of a world where this hurricane is yet to hit, and people don't seem to be ringing the alarm bells. There's not 100 programs on today about this same topic. There's this one, and maybe, you know, a handful of others, Keith Humphreys.
Yeah, I mean, Congresswoman Catherine Clark of Massachusetts organized a number of House members to write a letter to Margaret Chan, who was then the Director General of the World Health Organization, essentially, you know, encapsulating what we've just talked about in this program and warning the WHO that, you know, these industries are coming from the U.S. to the rest of the world, and be aware, be vigilant. And, you know, it generated no response that I can see. And I don't know why that is. If they think, well, that's an American problem, that's not going to spread, I'm really not sure. But, you know, there's often a problem in politics of responding to crises and not thinking about the long term. And this is a case, as Ron was saying earlier, where you have to think long term, because the first 5 years or 10 years, yeah, a lot of people are getting addicted, but, you know, you don't have the epidemic of deaths that sort of draws your attention in. And, you may not react quickly, but we need to find a way to do that, to help these countries, because they are really grossly overmatched otherwise.
Before this contagion hit its full force, before we were dealing with a decade stretching out from today where more than 50,000 people a year may be dying in the United States, there was an intellectually respectable, economically respectable debate over shifting the costs from the war on drugs to other means of addressing the problem of addiction in American society. and calling for basically an end to prohibition. You don't hear that, I don't think, quite so much anymore, Herman, do you?
Well, I mean, I personally went through a bit of this transformation where I used to, when I was very early on as a reporter covering this issue, I used to think, you know, drug legalization made sense. But at the end of the day, when you see what you see with drug legalization is that these big companies come in, they start marketing their products, and for whatever reason, maybe it is partly a U.S. issue in that the U.S. is very capitalistic. It just doesn't believe in big regulations over these big companies. For whatever reason, you see that these companies don't have much trouble getting their products to consumers. I mean, we've seen that with alcohol, even with tobacco, which is a crisis that we have thankfully addressed in a lot of ways over the past few decades. You still see, by some estimates, around 500,000 deaths a year to tobacco. That's still a huge death toll that the U.S. deals with every single year. So just seeing this growth of when you opened the font, when you like made it easier for people to get opioid painkillers, you saw this epidemic explode. And that to me signals that like, well, if you ease access to just about any other drug, these big companies are going to take advantage to it, and they're going to take advantage of it and market their drug irresponsibly, and it's going to get to consumers. And, you know, not everyone who uses them is going to get addicted, but enough are that it's going to cause a crisis. So I think that might be why you've seen less talk about ending prohibition for all drugs or shifting away from the war on drugs. I mean, in general, you have still seen some of that talk, right? So you've seen it with marijuana legalization. That's obviously taking off in the U.S., just happened in Canada. And you also have seen state governments pull back some of their harsher drug sentences, some of their harsher sentences for nonviolent crimes in general. So I think you still see some of that. But I think the idea of eliminating or getting rid of drug prohibition in general, of like suddenly legalizing heroin and fentanyl, it's just fentanyl, I should clarify, it's already legal for medical purposes. But anyway, this stance is just much less defensible after seeing the effects of the opioid crisis.
Professor Humphreys, is the ground on which the anti-prohibition argument now stands a little less secure, a little less solid because of what we're experiencing and what the globe is about to experience?
I think so. And, you know, I respect Herman for his public rethinking and of his views, as a number of other prominent people have done. I would say, you know, the part about the war on drugs some people are protesting is throwing people into a jail for using a drug. And with opioids, that's often a death sentence. They lose tolerance and they come out and then they overdose. And that is a serious problem. I think most people oppose that approach. And sort of think that's the only way to stop doing that is to get rid of prohibition. But that's not really true. I mean, we could say we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to provide treatment for those people without turning over the keys to public health to a corporation. I mean, it's very hard to argue that, you know, if only Purdue Pharma could have sold meth, we would be in better shape now than we are. We should have learned from this that we're not that great at controlling corporate behavior in the U.S. And yeah, some other countries are better, but I think the history is U.S. corporations are multinational. So it's kind of whoever is the weakest link ends up influencing the whole world. So we just need to keep those two ideas separate. You know, there's a difference between treating people who are addicted with respect, respecting their human rights and trying to help them versus just punish them. And we can do that without surrendering to a sort of corporate, you know, drug merchants.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Keith Humphreys. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, and Herman Lopez, senior correspondent at the online media source Vox. This program was moderated by my co-host, made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.